what I had to do in Washington on this occasion was probably my most important task of the whole war. I had to try and persuade Roosevelt and his advisors that our entire strategy needed rethinking. I pointed out that the Germans had 25 divisions stationed in France. With the pitiful number of landing craft we possessed, they could easily destroy any landing without shifting a single man from the Russian front. The Americans were rather shattered by this. Roosevelt was the first to grasp the point and to go on to the next question. What then could the British and Americans do in 1942? And this drew him back to something which he and Churchill had already tentatively discussed, the possibility of a landing not in Europe, but in French North Africa. Once this was accepted, the subsequent Mediterranean strategy inevitably followed from it, the invasion of Sicily, and then Italy. And once these were underway, equally inevitably, the invasion of Northwest Europe had to be pushed back to 1944. I was already reaching the conclusion that this would in any case be the earliest date we could manage. I wouldn't have dared say so in Washington bluntly in June 1942.
The invasion of Europe was still a long way off in 1942. But in that year, the turning point of the war was reached. Field Marshal Rommel's advance into Egypt was halted at the end of August. In October, General Montgomery won the Battle of El Alamein, the decisive victory of the Desert War. Now Mountbatten's work began to produce great results. Operation Torch, the Allied landing in North Africa in November, was the largest combined operation yet seen. The supreme commander of the Allied forces was General Eisenhower, making his first impression in the public eye. By May 1943, his campaign was won. A quarter of a million Germans and Italians laid down their arms. The Axis was beaten in Africa. Already, new combined operations were being planned. In January, Mountbatten had attended the Casablanca Conference, at which the decision was taken to invade Sicily. The Allied planners dared not guess the full results of their decision. The fall of Mussolini in July. So, fascism in Italy was beaten. The first of the dictators had been disposed of. Now the Allies prepared to land on the soil of Italy herself. Already the ultimate decision had been reached on the Eastern Front. The German surrender at Stalingrad was the first of a series of Russian victories which would cripple Germany. Once more, the Allied leaders gathered, this time at Quebec. They had much to discuss. Among other things, the creation of a new Southeast Asia command, which would include Burma, and the appointment of a supreme Allied commander. On August the 22nd, Churchill noted, "The President and General Marshall are very keen on Mountbatten's appointment. There is no doubt of the need of a young and vigorous mind in this lethargic and stagnant Indian scene." So the announcement was made officially from the Citadel at Quebec. "The King has been pleased to approve the appointment of Acting Vice Admiral the Lord Louis Mountbatten, GCVO DSO ADC, to be Supreme Allied Commander, Southeast Asia." Just over 4 months later, the Supreme Allied Commander for the invasion of Europe was appointed, General Dwight D. Eisenhower of the US Army. General Eisenhower, Ike to his armies and his friends, had displayed his great talent for getting men of many nations to work together.
From the very beginning, Admiral Mountbatten, Dickie I always called him, was an enthusiastic supporter of this plan. The first thing he did that I can recall was to come to see me, and we together began to going over all the reasons for choosing a particular area for attack. A number of the people thought we should go to Calais, which is just the shortest distance, of course. But for a number of reasons that he advanced, we came to the conclusion that we should land in the Cherbourg area and east thereof as far as Caen. There's where we finally landed.
I turned my back on Europe and on the war to overthrow Hitler. My enemy was Japan, at the peak of her power.
Already the Japanese were in Burma. By March the 10th, Rangoon was in their hands. Another triumph. From Rangoon, they advanced into Upper Burma. In 6 months, they had destroyed the British Empire in Southeast Asia. They stood at the gates of India, and there they had remained.
So now, I was a supreme Allied commander, a very grand title indeed. What's more, it was a very grand job. There weren't many of us about. No two supreme commands were quite alike. Mine, I think, was the most diverse. The bulk of my forces were Indian, British, and Gurkhas. I had a considerable number of Americans in the command, and a lot of Chinese, not to mention East and West Africans. There were Burmese, there were Australians, and there were French and Dutch. And somehow, they had all to be welded into one force. I set up my Southeast Asia Command headquarters in New Delhi. In our part of the world, everything seemed to be wrong. Our men coming from the Himalayas, or the plains of the Punjab, or from Glasgow, or Birmingham, found themselves groping in the jungle, and for 5 months of the year, nearly drowned in the Burma monsoon. I concluded that the first thing to do was to buck up their morale. I toured the whole command, all services, all nations, to explain to the men what the situation was, what we had to do, and how we could do it, to instill in them confidence that we were going to win.
A new wind blew through Siak. In the back areas, training continued, but training with a difference, training with a really offensive feel about it, and a strong suggestion that this time it would not all end as usual in miserable retreat. Training for combined operations, Mountbatten's speciality. A new formation had come into existence with a new name which had yet to make itself known, the 14th Army. Its commander was known in India, but his name meant little elsewhere. Lieutenant General W.J. Slim. Slim and Mountbatten understood each other. They had the same ideas about how the war should be conducted. Southeast Asia Command was now faced with a simple but unattractive prospect. A head-on conflict with the main body of the Japanese army in Burma. Both sides were preparing to take the offensive. The Japanese struck first. On February the 4th, 1944, they launched a diversionary attack in Arakan. Two British Indian divisions stood in Arakan. The Japanese once more attempted their well-tried tactics of infiltration and encirclement. Full of confidence, they attacked with 12,000 men, less than one division. They carried only 7 days' supplies. The retreating British would provide what they needed from captured dumps. But this time, the British did the unexpected. They did not retreat.
Part of our 7th Indian Division was very soon encircled, and the Japanese actually overran the divisional headquarters. But our men fought their way to their administrative base and stood fast under Brigadier Geoffrey Evans. We supplied them by air, and they slugged it out with the Japanese for 18 days. When the relieving forces got through, the tables were turned on the Japanese. It was their turn to be encircled, and their supplies had practically run out. They retreated with a loss of nearly 50% of their strength. We call this victory the Battle of the Admin Box. Arakan showed us that the first problem, morale, was solved.
The morale of one part of the army was not merely sound, it was effervescent. General Wingate's famous Chindits had already shown conclusively that British, Gurkha, and Burmese troops could march in the jungle, live in the jungle, and fight in the jungle. Now, with three times the strength, born in gliders, General Wingate was preparing to return to the Japanese back areas in Burma. The 1944 Chindit campaign was approved, despite the difficulty of meeting Wingate's insatiable demands, and despite the evidently impending Japanese attack. The fly-in to Burma took place on March the 5th. Chindit columns struck hard blows at the Japanese. Once again, the Chindits displayed wonderful endurance and courage.
3 weeks after the fly-in, Wingate was killed in an air crash. His death was a blow to the whole operation, and the strain on the Chindits themselves, wonderfully gallant as they were, was terrible. When we finally pulled them out, we found that over 50% of them were medically unfit for any more active service. His Chindits had done an incredibly courageous job, but this was a high price to pay.
The focus of the campaign now shifted north. Mountbatten was visiting Stillwell, discussing final plans. On his return, driving his own jeep, a front wheel passed over a bamboo stump, which then flew up and hit him on the left eye with tremendous force. When Mountbatten arrived at an American field hospital, it seemed likely that he would lose his eye.
This accident could hardly have come at a worse time. I had to spend 5 days in an American forward hospital, with both eyes bandaged, in complete blindness. And just at that moment, the Japanese attacked. They quickly cut off our fourth core in the Imphal plane, and a very serious situation developed. I persuaded the doctor to unbandage my eyes and let me out of hospital. I immediately flew to Army Air Headquarters, and there took one of the most serious decisions of the whole of my time as Supreme Commander. I took 30 American transport aircraft off the China supply route and used them to fly an infantry division into Imphal. This was dead against President Roosevelt's explicit instructions, but Roosevelt was a man of vision, and he accepted the situation.
The attack on Imphal began on March the 8th, 1944. The sternest battle of the Burma campaign had begun. The Japanese displayed their highest fighting qualities, mobility, aggressiveness, and endurance. They had practically no air support. Their supplies were slender. Once again, they counted on capturing what they needed from the British. From the moment of Mountbatten's decision to fly in the 5th Indian Division, a new factor had come into play. This was a significant development in the history of war. The first time a large normal formation had been transported from one battlefield to another by air. At Imphal, the British conducted a resolute offensive defense. And a new corps fought its way forward to relieve the garrison. After 74 days of battle, Imphal was relieved. Japanese remnants struggled back to Burma, starving, diseased, disorganized. Their casualties were over 53,000. The 14th Army had lost less than 17,000.
This complete defeat at Kohima and Imphal came as another very unpleasant shock to the Japanese. Their 15th Army had taken a fearful battering. But we had something else in store for him. I wrote in my dispatch, having expected that we would obey the rules and stop fighting during the monsoon when he stopped, the enemy had hoped to bring in reinforcements and rehabilitate his army to meet our post-monsoon offensive. But I didn't intend him to have an army to rehabilitate. I had concluded, even before I arrived out in Southeast Asia, that the stop-go, which the monsoon always imposed on fighting, just wouldn't do. I told my commanders back in October that I meant to fight on all through the monsoon. So now, without a pause, the 14th Army launched its offensive into Burma. Our object was never the occupation of any particular towns or areas. It was to destroy the Japanese army wherever it could be found.
A net was closing around the Japanese in Burma. In December, the British attacked in Arakan. Communiques reported victory on every sector of the front. The promise of victory opened up new horizons. In October, Mountbatten received a new directive from the Combined Chiefs of Staff. Your object is the destruction and expulsion of all Japanese forces in Burma at the earliest possible date. On January the 14th, 1945, the 19th Indian Division crossed the Irrawaddy at 2 points north of Mandalay. This was a diversionary attack. It succeeded brilliantly against fierce resistance as the Japanese hurried reinforcements up to liquidate the bridgeheads. On February the 12th, the 20th Division crossed west of Mandalay. The next day, much further west, the main assault went in, aimed at the vital road-rail junction of Mektila. Once out of the jungle, the British held the advantage. Now they could make full use of their armor and mechanized mobility. The Japanese were determined to hold the Irrawaddy line, but no amount of obstinate devotion on the part of their troops could halt the British and Indian offensive. Mektila fell on March the 5th. On the 20th, the Union Jack was hoisted again in Fort Dufferin.
"Come you back, you British soldier, come you back to Mandalay," said Kipling. Well, the British soldier was back in Mandalay. This was March 1945, and a lot was happening. 2 days after our 40th Army recaptured Mandalay, we heard that the 2nd Army had crossed the Rhine. Victory was in sight at last. You could feel it in the air, here in Burma, as well as in Europe.
The month of May came in with peals of victory. On the 1st, the German armies in Italy surrendered to Field Marshal Alexander. On the 2nd, the Russians entered Berlin. Adolf Hitler lay dead in the dismal bunker, which was all that remained of his Reich. On May the 7th, Germany submitted in unconditional surrender to General Eisenhower. May the 8th, 1945, VE Day. After 5.5 weary years of war, victory in Europe had been won.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is everywhere.
Victory in Europe was wonderful news for every one of us, a marvelous tonic. Mussolini and Hitler were dead, two of the most sinister figures who've ever threatened European civilization. But our war was not yet over. We still had to defeat Imperial Japan. The 14th Army was nearing Rangoon, but the monsoon was also approaching, and it was a toss-up which would win. On May the 4th, our forces landed just outside Rangoon and advanced on the city. Rangoon was reoccupied by us without having to be bombed or fought over. This may have been part of the reason for the tremendous reception we got from the Burmese population.
Rangoon was a milepost in the march to victory. The Japanese were completely defeated in Burma. Only remnants fought on, trying to make their escape through the encircling British forces. Yet in May 1945, it appeared that there was still heavy work ahead. The war against Japan came to its crescendo. In October 1944, General Douglas MacArthur's forces made their promised return to the Philippines. The general waded back ashore through the surf, a symbolic gesture to wash away the black memories of surrender in 1942. In April 1945, America and her allies suffered a grievous loss. The president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his fourth term of office, died with the victories which he had done so much to bring about in sight at last.
As Supreme Allied Commander, I had stood in a special relationship to him. He made that quite clear to me at Quebec when I was appointed. General Eisenhower, he told me, is as much a servant of your king as of me. I trust you will feel the same way about me in Southeast Asia. I promised him I would be a good American, and he laughed and thanked me. I've done my best to keep this promise, and he in turn had given me splendid backing, even when I've been forced to disregard his directives. I felt I'd lost a good friend and an understanding chief.
On July the 17th, 1945, the last of the great inter-allied conferences of the war, Potsdam.
I was only present at Potsdam for a short time, but it's hard to think of any similar span of time so packed with significance. I met the new American president, Mr. Truman, making his first big appearance on the world stage. I met Stalin. That was an experience. Immense decisions were taken at Potsdam. Decisions which have affected the whole world ever since. Some of them affected me in the most immediate and drastic manner. The unconditional surrender was enforced in Europe. Now, in July 1945, the same policy was also to be applied to Japan. At Potsdam, I was told the most closely guarded secret of the war, the story of the development of the atomic bomb. The American chiefs of staff, Generals Marshall and Arnold, now informed me that a bomb was about to be dropped on Japan. Mr. Churchill and President Truman both confirmed this to me. My SEAC staff had to rush forward all our plans for landing in Malaya and Singapore and just take my word for it that there'd be no opposition. It was a fantastic thought that this race of stubborn soldiers, who scarcely knew the meaning of fear, could be brought to their knees by one single dreadful weapon. Another great leader was now about to depart on the scene. At the Potsdam Conference, three men seemed to hold the world in the palms of their hands: Stalin, Truman, and Churchill. But on July the 25th, Winston Churchill flew off to London to hear the results of the 1945 general election. I don't think he had any premonition of what was coming. Winston Churchill and the Conservatives were swept out of office, and the Labour Party, headed by Clem Attlee, came in with a landslide victory. Already my job was becoming more political than military. When I reported to Mr. Attlee, I explained to him the line I proposed to take with the liberated territories when we'd driven the Japanese out of Southeast Asia, now an imminent prospect. I was delighted to find that I had his full backing. I had a feeling that I was going to need it.
Japan recoiled from unconditional surrender. She knew she was beaten, but could find no way of obtaining peace. The town of Hiroshima, the seventh largest in Japan, contained an arsenal, oil refineries, factories, a large garrison of soldiers. It was a military target. It also contained 343,000 people. At 9 minutes past seven on the morning of August the 6th, 1945, four American B-29s appeared in the cloudless sky above Hiroshima. The air raid siren sounded. 22 minutes later, the planes had gone. The all clear was heard. People emerged from their shelters and went about their lives. But there was a fifth plane in the sky that day. A Japanese journalist tells what followed. Suddenly, a glaring, whitish, pinkish light appeared in the sky, accompanied by an unnatural tremor, which was followed almost immediately by a wave of suffocating heat and a wind which swept away everything in its path. Within a few seconds, the thousands of people in the streets in the center of the town were scorched by a wave of searing heat. Many were killed instantly. Others lay writhing on the ground, screaming in agony from the intolerable pain of their burns. Everything standing upright in the way of the blast, walls, houses, factories, was annihilated. Hiroshima had ceased to exist.
More Japanese died at Okinawa than at Hiroshima. How many Okinawas did we want? That was really how we thought about the bomb, as a means of ending this terrible war as quickly as possible. Even now, it took a second bomb, 3 days later, on Nagasaki to make Japan sue for peace. This was what civilization had come to. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were appalling lessons. I hope they will never be forgotten.
On August the 14th, Japan submitted in unconditional surrender. The surrender was signed in Tokyo Bay, aboard the American battleship Missouri, on Sunday, September the 2nd, 1945. General MacArthur was designated to accept the Japanese submission on behalf of the Allied powers. On September the 12th, in the Council Chamber of Singapore Town Hall, flanked by his senior officers and in the presence of military representatives of the United States, India, Australia, China, France, and Holland, Mountbatten accepted the surrender of 680,879 Japanese in Southeast Asia.
So now the war was really over. And looking back on it all now, one can see something else. Our campaign was the swan song of the British Empire in the Far East. It was not an unworthy one.
Victory. Victory in the desert. Victory in Italy. Victory in Northwest Europe. Victory in Burma. Victory in the skies. Victory at sea. Once again, in 1946, as in 1919, the moment was marked by a great parade of all the forces of the Commonwealth. Once again, the flags were carried through London streets with pride. It was not yet time to count the cost. It was time to cheer and give heartfelt thanks. This time, London itself had been in the line of battle. Few knew better than Londoners what this victory meant. This war against fascist aggressors had been a war for liberty. And this parade was a thanksgiving that British liberty had been once again preserved. Once again, a nation in arms paid glad tribute to its services.